If you're gay, then you're gay. Don't pretend that you're straight. You could be who you are any day of the week. You are unlike the others, so strong and unique. We're all with you.
If you're straight, well, that's great. You can help procreate and make gay little babies for the whole human race. Make a world we can live in where the one who you love's not an issue. 'Cause we're all somewhere in the middle. We're all just looking for love to change the world. And we're all here in it together.
Thanks for tuning in, and welcome to the February 17th, 2020 edition of IMRU Radio Magazine.
The world's longest-running lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender radio show, now including the queer and intersex communities in our mission statement and proudly promoting our allies.
Hello, I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Chloe Corcoran. Tonight, we'll explore the surprisingly sensual world of tomatoes, and Michael Taylor Gray is on location at this year's 2019 Dorian Awards, sponsored by the Association of LGBTQ Entertainment Critics, celebrating the best in mainstream international film and television.
And we'll find out where Wayne is this week, won't we?
Absolutely.
But first, the Honest Tea. Well, Chloe Corcoran, it seems like we have a definite theme to this week's Honest Tea, and I would say it is something like, come out wherever you are.
You love to see it.
I do. It's amazing because I don't know what is in the air or in the water, but the first story we have comes from LGBTQNation.com by Alex Bollinger from Friday, February 14th, 2020. The Flash actor, Rick Cosnett, comes out as gay. Now, he says that coming out is hard because of internalized homophobia, but he made a promise to myself to live my truth every day. Rick Cosnett, 36, plays Detective Eddie Thawn on CW's The Flash. He came out as gay in an Instagram video.
And he also adds that most of you probably knew anyway, which resonates with my story because I think I was out before I came out. And that's just the way that that works sometimes. But congrats to him for being able to step out and live his truth.
I thought it was really important what he was saying. He said, I just wanted everyone to know because I've made a promise to myself to live my truth every day. And sometimes that is a really hard thing to do when you have all these subconscious things that you don't even know about from childhood and society and from just life. Now, he came out on a video. Now, he's a white cisgendered male. Mm-hmm. So it seemed like there's a little bit more freedom sometimes being that white cisgendered male that you're able to do things like this. I'm just pointing that out because our second story has a little bit of a different take on coming out.
Yes.
And how she came out.
So somebody else came out this week,
right.
And that was Jamila Jamil.
Right.
And what did we learn from this story? She came out on Twitter, which is different than Instagram.
She did. But I just want to backtrack for a moment. If you want to see Rick Cosnett's Instagram video, he's at Rick Cosnett, R-I-C-K-C-O-S-N-E-T-T. And, you know, he has a certain sense of nervousness and relief and humility in this video because we can actually see him do this. But for Jamila Jamil, she came out on Twitter and her handle is at Jamila Jamil. That's J-A-M-E-E-L-A, J-A-M-I-L. Now, she is a 30-something South Asian. So things were a little tougher for her. And she came out officially as queer.
Correct.
Yeah, which I thought was interesting.
And that's a little bit different coming out on Twitter than it is coming out on Instagram. And it's still a very vulnerable position. But I feel like it may be a little bit different than doing a video. What do you think?
Well, it's a little bit more, it's a safer way. You know what I mean? But I don't know, she didn't feel as if she couldn't come out with a video, which is a little bit more vulnerable. There was a little more vulnerability to that. So there's a little bit of safety behind text. Sometimes, you know, some people hide behind text for nefarious reasons. Some people hide behind text just to protect themselves. And I think I got that sense from her. But she wrote a very, very long missive to her followers on Twitter. She didn't come from a family with anyone openly out. You know, it's also scary as an actor to openly admit your sexuality, especially when you're already a brown female in your 30s, she wrote, as I stated. And she added a rainbow to her name, quote unquote, when I felt really a few years ago, as it's not easy within the South Asian community to be accepted. And I always answered honestly, if ever straight up asked about it on Twitter, she wrote. And her coming out spurred on by recent controversies surrounding her being cast as a lead judge on HBO Max's upcoming reality show Legendary about voguing.
Yes, a lot of people were frustrated. Voguing comes from ballroom culture, which is largely Black and Latinx culture. And
Latinx
is a term to be gender inclusive of Latinas and Latino people. It includes our non-binary friends as well. So Jamila does not come from that culture, and other people have and didn't get a shot on the show. And Jamila's response to that is sometimes it takes somebody with a little bit more star power to get the show up and running, to get it to be seen, and to give other people an opportunity.
But she was also being miscorrectly designated. She was being criticized on social media for being cisgendered and a straight woman.
That's true. And she has come out as not straight, but that also doesn't make you part of the ballroom culture necessarily. And she talks about that. She's very open about it. She says that being queer doesn't make her part of the ballroom culture. And she says that she was cast because she doesn't have that experience and the audience may identify better with her.
Exactly. The show's creators also wanted someone as a judge who isn't familiar with ballroom culture, so audience members, like you said, could tune in and have somebody to identify with on the show. Absolutely. Because we want that person that is kind of discovering it along with us. And I think that's a perfectly legitimate, there's precedence for that in a lot of reality shows. You know, the downside of social media, though, is that on the last lines of her coming out, her Twitter post read, "I'm jumping off this hell app for a while, because I don't want to read mean comments dismissing this. You can keep your thoughts." That's unfortunate, because that is. I mean, that's the dark side of it. That's the downside of social media sometimes, because people will jump on and just have an emotional reaction and a judgy kind of reaction without understanding the full scope of how she became part of this. Now, we know her primarily from her role on The Good Place on NBC, the comedy on NBC.
We're also in an era of unprecedented access to celebrities through apps like Twitter. And with that comes a lot of criticism from any corner of the world. People with the credentials to have something to say and people without any credentials that to have an informed opinion on something like this. So that can be difficult for a lot of people because there's not as much of a barrier as there used to be. And we're getting looks into things that we haven't in a long time. And that shows itself with an upcoming documentary film as well. And what is coming out on Apple TV?
Debuted February 14th, 2020, Ryan White, who is a noted gay documentarian, created a show with Apple TV Plus, a docuseries called Visible. And Visible Out on Television is one of the most ambitious productions yet to chronicle the history of the LGBTQ movement, in this case, through the lens of how it's been reflected on television. Now, director Ryan White, he's 38 years old, discusses decades of queer visibility and invisibility, chronicled in the Apple TV Plus docuseries. It's a five-part docuseries. It begins in the 1950s, when the only mentions of homosexuality on television involved trial coverage related to the Lavender Scare, and ends with the New Guard in present day, with an unprecedented number of LGBTQ characters on television. Now, for those who don't know what the Lavender Scare was, that was a moral panic about homosexual people in the U.S. government and their mass dismissal from government service. It contributed to and is paralleled to the anti-communist campaign known as McCarthyism and the Second Red Scare.
One of the things I like about this show is that it moves chronologically, so we can see the growth. We can see the difficulties in the very beginning, and we can see what's happened since then. And moving to in a place where we wish it was a little bit further, most likely, because we'd like to have more representation. And we're seeing great strides, just always want to push for more. And I think that's what a lot of the people in the LGBTQ community and the acting community are doing, is pushing that envelope, trying to get those spots and trying to be representative of the community that we come from.
Yeah, and it was important that the producers of The Apple TV Plus wanted somebody in particular. They loved the idea of this show. They didn't want it to be just a clip show. And they wanted to bring a documentary filmmaker on board to give it shape. And that's how director Ryan White joined the team. And it's a who's who of LGBTQ plus actors, activists, and allies. You've got the narrators Janet Mock, Margaret Cho, Asia Kate Dillon, Neil Patrick Harris, and Lena Waithe. And Lena Waithe, I loved what she said. She said, "I didn't realize that I was the revolution I was waiting for."
That's powerful.
Isn't that wonderful? And segment contributors include Laverne Cox, Don Lemon from CNN, George Takei from the original Star Trek series, Sheila Kuehl, a local politician in Los Angeles, Raven Simonet from Disney and The Cosby Show, Norman Lear, an iconic film, TV producer, and the one and only Oprah.
And Ellen is also interviewed in this documentary as well. And one of the things that struck me about this article was that they talk about how emotional and serious she got when talking about her coming out story. And the assumption on the interviewer's part that she has probably told this story a million times and is comfortable with it. But seeing that emotion was surprising for the interviewer, and how hard it doesn't always get easier to tell that story because it's filled with a lot of pain and trauma.
Well, in knowing the depth and breadth of what this docuseries was covering, I think probably helped open that emotional gate for her, perhaps. And I just think this is wonderful that this is now going to be this is now available for us to embrace our culture and our history from the 1950s up to present day. And it reminds me of a recent guest that we had, Zaylor Stout, who is the author of the book Our Gay History in 50 States. And I think all of a sudden we have this plethora of content available to us when for decades and decades and decades we haven't had any access publicly, and it's just such a wide breadth of what our stories are. Where's our history come from? Who are our allies? Who are our activists? You know, not just people in the entertainment industry, which I love that this covers so much beyond just film and television, even though it talks about who you identified with, who was represented in film and television, or television particularly during this time.
And it points to something that's often been said is you don't know where you're going if you don't know where you've been. And this, as an aside, but also very important corollary, is the burning of all the science and all the books on transgender people by the German Reich prior to World War II. And people have said, well, where is all this transgender stuff coming from? It hasn't existed before. It did, and it was studied, and it was written about, and all of that information was burned. So having access to this type of information and representation and seeing yourself is so important to so many people, especially youth, seeing that, okay, somebody has come before me. It may not be easy, but it's been done. If they can do it, I can do it too.
We have plenty of opportunities to be woke.
We certainly do. And Wendy Williams has an opportunity to be woke right now, too.
Snap. Yes, Wendy Williams slammed for saying gay men should stop wearing our skirts and heels. She apologized, saying, quote unquote, "I did not mean to offend my LGBTQ plus community on yesterday's show." This is from NBCNews.com, NBC Out, by Janelle Griffith from February 13th, 2020. She goes on to say, "I don't care if you're gay," adding that gay men don't menstruate every 28 days. "You can do a lot that we do, but I get offended by the idea that we go through something you will never go through."
This is also a coded attack on transgender people and something for us to look out for, because a lot of people will equate being a woman to menstruating. So what does that say to women who can't menstruate, who don't menstruate? And what does that say to transgender men who may menstruate? She's really trying to draw a line between what she considers a real woman and what she considers somebody playing as a woman.
And this was, some thought, a veiled barb towards Billy Porter from Pose, who wore some fabulous outfits for the Academy Awards and other awards this past year, as he's been lauded, and not just as a host or on the red carpet. So it just reminds me, we were talking prior to the show, about I went and saw Donna Summer at the Hollywood Bowl. And this was not long prior to her death. She died of cancer. And she made a point of saying to the audience an apology. Because there was one point in her career, right when she left singing full time to go raise her family, she made some comments about the gay community. particularly gay men, that weren't very positive at all. Mm-hmm. She really derided us because she was kind of cloaking that in her religion. And it wasn't until she came back and decided to revive her career that she realized the damage that she had done. And she apologized to the audience, saying, you know, you were my gay men in particular, she said, were my core audience. I wouldn't have had a career if it wasn't for your community. And I really appreciated the fact that she took the moment to recognize her shortcomings and apologize not for offending us, but apologizing for her beliefs and how she had been enlightened since that point.
And that's a big difference.
Right. And Wendy's not apologizing for her beliefs. She's apologizing if I'm offended. That's not the question here. That's not at question. Yes, you offended people. That's already been pretty well decided. Now, let's examine what you actually said, Wendy. It's your belief system that needs to be looked at. Right. And you need to apologize for that, for your words.
And we have a surprising exclamation from a politician about their belief system and who they would and would not vote for that I did not see coming. And I'm a little skeptical about, if I'm being honest.
Yes, you are being honest, because this is the honest tea. Now, NBCNews.com, NBC Out, by Tim Fitzsimmons, from Thursday, February 13th, 2020. Here's the headline. Trump says he would vote for a gay president. I got nothing.
I don't even know what to say.
I need some more tea.
So in the interest of self-preservation, I'm going to leave this one alone, but we thought that you should know that he did say that.
Yeah, and you can go online and find out more if you like.
Yes.
And that's the honest tea.
Don't go away. We'll be right back after this quick break.
Bessie Smith, Empress of the Blues, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Born in 1894 in Tennessee, a poverty-stricken Bessie sang for nickels on street corners at age 9. In 1923, she did an about-face with her first hit recording, Downhearted Blues. Bessie connected to black and white audiences alike, belting out songs of yearning, love, and loss. Bolstering her popularity was her image as a sassy, self-assured black woman. But combining that temperament with a thirst for moonshine made for a stormy personal life. When beset with anger, a brawl often ensued. Her opportunistic second husband, Jack G., was physically abusive, especially over her affairs with women. Bessie's career slumped after the crash of 29. Ironically, her final blow came in 1937 in a car crash on a lonely southern highway. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Gizbo.
Hello, I'm Pandora Box, and you are listening to I Am RU Radio Magazine.
I am RU.
Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Chloe Corcoran.
And now, the eternal question.
Why is Trump president?
No.
Why are we so cute?
No. Where's Wayne?
This is Wayne Sampson at the new Academy Museum of Motion Pictures. It's scheduled to open later this year. It's located on Wilshire Boulevard. It's the Old May Building. The Oscar Museum will be the place to visit to see all things Oscars for the history of all the Oscars and everything, including filmmaking. So we're going to talk to the head of the place for the 411. So introduce yourself and your title to our listeners, please.
Bill Kramer, CEO and director of the Academy Museum of Motion Pictures.
And so we got a great tour today. Thank you for having us here at the museum. And there's a lot to look forward to. Can you give us a brief overview of what we can expect?
So we're building the world's largest museum devoted to the celebration and exploration of motion pictures. Five stories of exhibition spaces that will look at a wide variety of filmmakers, film artists, genres, themes. We're opening our temporary galleries with an exhibition on Miyazaki, the Japanese animator. We'll have a two-story core exhibition that talks about the history of cinema, the stories of cinema, but in a very very dynamic, inclusive way. We want to tell complete stories. We want people to leave here learning about filmmakers and film artists and movies that they've never heard of before. We'll have a robust public screening series in our two theaters, the 1,000-seat David Geffen Theater and the 280-seat Ted Mann Theater, and we'll have a very strong K-12 program knitted and connected to the city of Los Angeles.
And when can we expect this all to open?
We're making an announcement very soon, but it will open this year, and the public opening date is shortly being announced.
So 2020, we can expect it to open. And I hear there's going to be a shop on Wilshire Boulevard, facing Wilshire Boulevard, and also a restaurant dining option. Are those going to open before, or will those open all at the same time?
Everything will open at the same time, but we're going to have an incredible retail space. We'll be selling a lot of film books and objects made especially for the Academy Museum connected to movies and movie making, and then a beautiful restaurant that will be, I think, a beacon for people in Los Angeles.
Now, our show's an LGBT show. Will there be any focus on that specifically, or will that kind of rotate in and out?
Queer filmmakers are represented. LGBTQ filmmakers are represented. Very soon, we're announcing our exhibitions plan. I think you'll be very happy with one of our upcoming temporary exhibitions. But that's a key part of telling the story of cinema. And we are committed to telling diverse and inclusive stories. So the answer is absolutely.
And do you work with outside festivals like Outfest at all, like coming up with those curators?
We have a lot of incredible partners. We've built our curatorial team. We're working with Academy members and other partners to curate spaces. So we're bringing in a lot of influences into the museum.
And what is one thing that has been special for you as the CEO of the museum to be involved with this?
Well, I'm honored that I'm able to do this. It's really a privilege. The Academy and the City of Los Angeles have been working to build a museum of this scale devoted to motion pictures since 1930. So I'm so thrilled to be here when we finally open our doors to the world. It's an honor. I'm very excited.
How long has it been since you started the project until now?
Well, I was here for about 5 years, raised the money to build the project, moved on to another assignment that was very interesting, but just came back to open the project, and I've been working on the project since late September.
Wayne Sampson for IMRU, reporting live from the Academy Museum on Wilshire Boulevard. Talk to you later.
Well, I tell you, you just never know where Wayne's going to show up.
Absolutely.
So, Wayne, I applaud you. Keep that mystery alive. And now, just in time for planting season, something ripe and luscious. Not just you, Chloe Corcoran. We revisit Wenzel Jones' talk with top chefs Paul McCullough.
Summertime, and the living is easy.
Yes, it's true. Summertime is actually here. And what does summer mean to everybody? Tomatoes. And so to talk tomatoes, we've called in Food Network star finalist chef Paul McCullough and producer, director, writer Jeremy Sanford to talk to us about the world of tomatoes. So welcome, gentlemen. You are the men who literally wrote the book on tomatoes.
We did.
We literally did.
We love our aromatherapy book.
And we should point out that's Roma starting with an R, as in Roma tomato. Now, summer has been here a long time at this point.
Oy.
When should the tomatoes have gone in?
Well, in LA, the season starts early. So mid-March is when you can get your tomatoes in the ground, as long as the plot that you picked for your tomatoes gets about 6 to 8 hours of sun a day.
Well, now, how big is your garden? Because you guys are a lot more serious than most people.
That's a personal question, how big my garden is.
And how does it grow, sir?
It grows. Lovely. We have a pretty large backyard with a beautiful avocado tree and an orange tree. And currently, we have 22 tomato plants in raised beds.
And how many varieties have you guys gone with?
Out of 24, I think I probably have 20 varieties and 4 repeats.
And what is your favorite?
What's your favorite, Jeremy? I always buy the Aussie.
The Roma. We actually have a couple of Romas this year. Paul has not had much success growing Roma tomatoes, but we have 2 that are actually thriving.
The irony.
The irony. Yes, after writing the book about them.
I've never been able to grow a Roma that didn't have the blossom end rot, didn't just look like this stunted version of something that I wished it could be. But this year, I have two San Marzanos, and they are looking amazing. I brought Jeremy out. I'm like, honey, look, I think the curse is lifted.
And those are expensive when you buy them in the store, too. So nicely done. Now, to get back to varieties, because a lot of people are afraid if they don't see a red tomato.
Right.
Like, I've read that they can't really sell yellow tomatoes in Europe because Europeans just don't cotton to them. What is the difference between varieties beyond the cosmetic? Because I know there are white ones that actually look like organs out there.
Mm. Organs?
Like drunk kidneys or something. I mean, it looks like a plant uterus.
Yeah.
That's exactly what it looks like.
Well, originally they were yellow. I mean, the very first tomatoes were yellow. And that's where the Italian word pomodoro comes from, because it's a golden apple.
But is a difference in texture and flavor? Is it just
everything? Yeah, everything.
Texture, flavor, the water content, the thickness of the skin, the meatiness of the fruit inside. Some people say, oh, you should never just slice a Roma tomato and eat it on a sandwich. Well, actually, this year when I picked the ones that I've actually grown, they're absolutely delicious. And the green zebra stripes are a perfect example of a green tomato that, as it ripens up, you just think, is that ripe? Is that ripe? And then as it's ripening up, it gets a nice yellow sort of blush over the top of it. And the stripes just go really deep green to the bottom to this really pale green on top. And it's bright and acidic and just amazing and delicious. You can cut some of those and top it on a piece of halibut. And there's just so many varieties that we can grow here in California. The chocolate stripes and the little yellow pears and the beefsteaks and the Aussies, and they're ones that are shaped like peppers.
Now, what are the Aussies? Because I know you mentioned that that's one of your favorites.
Well, they're generally big and thick.
We're talking tomatoes, right?
We are.
Okay.
Because a tomato's a weed, and it wants to not stand up. It wants to sprawl all over your garden, just keep sending out tendrils, and just have as many tomatoes as possible.
One thing you'll notice the varieties of tomatoes is the thickness of the wall, and that's why Romas are a paste tomato, which is one of the sort of four main categories. And they have a much thicker wall, which is less seeds and more wall. And that's why they use those for tomato paste, tomato sauce, just because it's a much thicker media tomato.
Here's a question somebody asked me. The suckers, that little tiny shoot between the branch and the main stem, they said, make sure you take them off. And I always mean to, but then I run out of energy.
To pinch or not to pinch?
Exactly. What are your feelings, gentlemen?
I'm a no-pinch kind of guy. But I know some people like to do it, but I don't think you need to.
Are you staring at Paul with...
As I pinch him. I think you need to pinch a little bit, because my raised bed only has so much space. And for example, this one plant that I have is really growing, and it is like gangbusters. If I don't pinch off some of that growth, it's going to take over and shade my other plants. There's not going to be as much airflow, which is really important in your tomato garden. So I'd say pinch 50% of what you have.
Now, here's a to get precious. When people talk about grapes, they always like to talk about the terroir and the flavors it brings from the local soil into the fruit. Do tomatoes actually do that to a degree that you've noticed, or is that just beyond twee?
I think they do. You know, our friends up in Ojai have an amazing plot of land, and they have all the space they want to need, so they never pinch, and they have really hard clay soil. And so they're amending a lot. But the tomatoes, we both grew green zebra stripes. His green zebra stripes had a distinctly different flavor when we went and tasted than mine did, growing here in my backyard on Gardner Street and in my raised bed, where I've amended the soil with compost and worm casings and cow poop and Miracle-Gro potting soil to give it as much as possible, because without it, I'm just sticking a tomato plant in my ground in the backyard is not a favorable condition for that plant. So,
what do you do to keep pests away, short of spraying everything with malathion, which I assume we all don't think is a good thing?
And then Dr. Earth has a really great organic insect spray. But I think, you know, like roses like to be fussed over, I think your tomato plant likes to be handled a little bit. And check it out. If you see some small pests, you get some of that spray on there, pick off the big ones.
And it is a good idea to not to grow your tomatoes in the same area of your yard every year, because then the pest can get established there.
Okay, now there's undeniably nothing better than a fresh tomato from the garden with just a little sprinkling of salt. But what is your favorite simple thing to do that isn't quite that simple when you've got a warm tomato right in your hand?
And one of the easiest things to do is just, if you have Roma tomatoes, anything, cut them in half, little oil, salt, pepper, stick them in your oven, and just roast them. And it really develops the flavor, and they get super sweet, and the flavor is amazing. So generally, tomatoes like to struggle a little bit. You don't want to overwater them, because you can actually dilute the taste.
Anyway, because this is the Gay Agenda Show, we have selected for your edification a variety of tomatoes that you may find interesting. I found a tomato called Aunt Ruby's German Cherry, which sounds like a lesbian euphemism. This is a green cherry tomato. What did you find, Paul?
I found one called the White Queen.
Ooh.
She's a big round girl with a beautiful green top.
I ran across one that shares its name with the fourth book in the Armistead Maupin Tales of the City series. It's called Baby Cakes. And it's a red cherry with, and I quote, a natural salty flavor.
Mmm. Mm. What about the beef master?
What about the beef
master? I mean, that just opens up a whole... I mean, everyone needs a good beef master in their garden.
Beef master.
Beef master.
Jeremy?
And the beef master is good friends with a pink pounder. you... And if you're lucky, you can grow both at the same time. Are you familiar with a pink pounder?
Is it large?
Oh, yes.
It's pink and it's large.
That's all you need. Well, I did run across one called Sappho.
Sappho?
Mm-hmm. It's a red cherry with a sweet acid flavor.
Mm.
Sappho. Well, gentlemen, this has been a most satisfying little tour through the world of tomatoes. Thank you so much for coming out.
Oh, well, thank you. It's nice to be here again.
Well, it's lovely to see you all again. So, for more information, people go to romatherapy.com and don't forget the hyphen between Roma and therapy. Also, paulskitchen.com to find out more about Mr. McCullough.
There you go. And if anyone is listening and would like to order the book as a special, extra special gift, we have this great aromatherapy magnet that we'll throw in there as well. And it's got all these measure equivalents and it's wonderful for baking. So,
why, I'm looking at one right now and I can't wait to put it up on my refrigerator when I get home. So thank you again for coming out, Paul McCullough and Jeremy Stanford. And this is Wenzel Jones for IMRU.
Midsummertime, summertime, 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 summertime. It's summertime.
Who knew there was so much to learn about tomatoes? And wow, I'm feeling a little hot myself.
I'm a little flush. I need a cigarette. And I don't even smoke.
I didn't even know that I liked tomatoes until now.
I think that was PG-13, don't you think?
Well, we learned a lot, that's for sure.
I'm going to go out and buy as many tomatoes as I can right now. Don't go away. We'll be right back with the 2019 annual
Gallica
Awards.
A monument for Bessie Smith, coming up now on the Rainbow Minute. Blues singing empress Bessie Smith was tragically killed in a car crash on September 26, 1937, leaving behind her soulful voice on over 160 recordings. Her funeral was attended by thousands of grieving fans, yet her grave remained unmarked until 1970. That year, Juanita Green of Philadelphia and Janis Joplin, a well-known singer herself, secured a marble gravestone to memorialize Bessie. In Bessie Smith's biography by Jackie Kay, she wrote that Joplin had always been a great admirer of Bessie Smith, which had a profound influence in Joplin's music. As fate would have it, Joplin herself died less than 2 months after her benevolent deed on the 33rd anniversary of Bessie Smith's funeral. The Rainbow Minute is produced by Judd Proctor and Brian Burns and recorded in the studios at WRIR in Richmond, Virginia, and read by volunteers like me, Giz Bowe.
You are listening to IMRU Radio Magazine, and I am Antonio Banderas.
Yes, you are. Welcome back. I'm Michael Taylor Gray.
And I'm Chloe Corcoran.
I had the wonderful opportunity of attending the 2019 Dorian Awards, which were held at Patrick Moran's home in beautiful Hancock Park. Patrick is the former ABC Studios head, and now he's branching out with a wonderful deal with Amazon, producing a new series called Citadel. But Patrick was hosting the 2019 Dorian Awards, which are presented by
Gallica,
which is the organization of LGBTQ entertainment journalists, celebrating the best in mainstream and international film and television from 2019. So it was quite a day. And Olivia Wilde was the Artist of the Year award, and she was being recognized for her film Booksmart. Then Antonio was given the Best Actor, Lead Actor of the Year for Pain and Glory. And I was hoping that J-Lo was going to be there for to receive her Best Actress nod, but she was busy that day doing a little show called the Super Bowl. But anyway, here goes. Listen in. Within our ever-expanding LGBTQI+ community, there are many heartfelt, challenging, intriguing, and entertaining stories to tell. I'm Michael Taylor Gray, and this is Storytellers. Hi, I'm at the 2019 Dorian Award Winners Toast here in beautiful Hancock Park by Gallica, Association of LGBTQ Entertainment Critics, and I'm speaking with
Patrick Moran.
Patrick, you are our host today, so thank you for opening up your home to today's event.
Sure.
I've heard you've got some good news. You have a great deal with Amazon that you're very proud of for Citadel.
Yes, I just made an overall deal at Amazon Studios. One of the first shows that I'll be working on is Citadel from the Russo Brothers at Midnight Radio.
Now, that's going to be an international series from what I understand, right? It's going to be in several different countries, not just here in the United States.
The mothership will actually be produced out of the UK. There are five other kind of international series being developed concurrently along with this one.
So is this part of your transition from ABC to being on your own?
Well, yes, the transition really was leaving the executive ranks and moving into something that was more producerial. And I was just lucky enough that this opportunity came to me and I was happy to join the team.
Does this provide you like more creative leeway in terms of your involvement?
Yeah, being a producer, yes. The hope anyway is that it feels more focused on the creative process and getting a little bit out of the bureaucratic or organizational side of things. So that's the hope.
So you know the organizational founder for Gallica, for G-A-L-E-C-A, the Association of LGBTQ Entertainment Critics, John Griffins. And how did you meet John?
I've known John for, gosh, 20 plus years. He was one of the first people I met when I moved to Los Angeles. And, you know, he has such a fantastic outgoing personality that we've just stayed friends ever since.
Well, he must be able to just pick up the phone and say, hey, can you open up your home to this event?
I would only do it for John. So I'm happy to participate.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to celebrate the best in film and television here with our community.
Yeah, happy to do it.
This is Michael Taylor Gray with Storytellers and IMRU Radio Magazine. And I just ran into who?
Dennis Hensley.
Dennis Hensley.
I host the podcast Dennis Anyone. I'm just here to celebrate the winners. I was one of the people that voted. This is a beautiful place we're at. I feel like I just walked into a fancy movie or something.
This is how the other half lives.
Clearly.
Not the other half, the other 1%.
The other 1%, yeah. I'm going to parasite this family. I'm going to parasite them.
Speaking of parasite,
I'm their dog
parasite
walker
is the big winner this year.
It deserves it. I just saw it for the second time, and I can't believe how good it is. And it's so timely to the way we live now.
Worse than a have-not.
Yes. If you are a have-not, you've got the smell of it on you, and you're never going to be able to improve your lot. Forces in our culture are making it more and more unfair every single day.
So how did you get involved with this organization? Well, how did you become a voter?
John Griffiths is somebody that I know from journalism. My background is magazine articles. I wrote for Movie Line and Detour and Cosmopolitan and a lot of different magazines when magazines were more prominent. So we knew each other from those days. So when I started my podcast, which covers a lot of different types of creative people, filmmakers and writers and singers and all kinds of stuff, they invited me to be a member. And I love the way it's grown over the years. I'm really proud of our choices this year because they do have a point of view that is uniquely queer, even on the more mainstream stuff. I was on Team J-Lo for the whole Oscar season and loved the choices that the group made. And I loved how they're getting more and more visibility. You'll see the awards listed in ads for films and things like that. And I think it's great because there's Facebook groups and stuff. You were able to share our work that we've done. Like, hey, check out this interview. I think you'll find it interesting. And we're able to sort of help each other figure out the lay of the land in terms of jobs and who's using writers and who's not. And how much are they getting paid? It's tough as a freelancer out there to try to piece it all together. And it's nice to have allies and other people that are trying to do the same thing. What I did for my job for the first 15 years of my career, you can't do that anymore. So how are people navigating that? Where are they finding other opportunities, related opportunities, starting their own things?
It's very entrepreneurial.
I think you have to be. It's like, yeah. And I think that Parasite speaks to, it's what Hustler speaks to. You got to have an angle.
You got to be a parasite and a hustler.
Yes. Or there's no place for you. I think that's why movies like Parasite and Hustlers and some other things resonate, because it's not enough to work hard and play by the rules and be a decent person. You've got to have a gimmick.
You are listening to I Am Are You Radio Magazine, and I am Antonio Banderas.
I want to congratulate you on your Best Actor Award for Pain and Glory here at the 2019 Dorian Awards. How do you feel about that?
I feel great. I feel, you know, that I am recognized by the people that actually my character represents in a way is very beautiful. It seems to me that the character was presented with honesty, that it was believable, that it represents a community that had a lot to say, that have been fighting for many years. For me, it's an important award, definitely.
We want to thank you for being an ally to our community, because we can't be stronger and grow and connect more to the world community than without our allies. So having you as part of that community, we're very proud of that, and we're thankful for the work that you do as an artist and just as a human being.
Yeah, I think it's very important, actually, that there are people that actually are not gay that are supporting this community. That is essential to the normalization of the situation, because otherwise it becomes a ghetto, and you guys are not a ghetto. You and the aspirations of this community is just to be normal. Our life, or your life, is absolutely normal in every level, in every aspect of American society, the world society. And there is a lot, you know, I've been working in countries where this is unbelievably taboo. Countries in Europe, you know, you're talking about Bulgaria, I'm talking about Hungary, about Russia, you know, the communities of gays there are suffering real repression still in our days, you know. So that's why it's important, I think, people that don't straight, you know, belong to the community, because we are not, this is not our sexual option, but you understand absolutely all the rights that people in all the departments have. So, yeah, you have all my support, but you have my support, I think, you know, from a long time ago.
Yeah, you've been consistent, so thank you. We're allies, so thank you so much.
You know, I am in the position that I wanted to be. I'm more than paid off, you know, for the movie. I'm very happy. But remember, to everybody that is listening to this, freedom doesn't come for free. You have to fight for it every single day.
This is Michael Taylor Gray with IMRU Radio Magazine, and I'm speaking to the man that created it all, the Dorian Awards 2019.
I'm just having fun because I'm in a good mood, because we just had a wonderful 11th Dorian Awards winners toast. We had Olivia Wilde here and Antonio Banderas and Andrew Ridings from gay-themed sitcom on Comedy Central, our unsung TV show of the year. He's the sort of closeted straight guy that has a penchant for sexy times.
Now, you failed to tell us who you are.
My name is John Griffiths. I am the executive director of Gallica, the Society of LGBTQ Entertainment Critics, home of the Dorian Awards, that go to TV and film the best of the year, not just gay stuff, but everything. We have LGBTQ categories as well as, quote, mainstream.
This organization wasn't in existence 11 years ago. So yeah. What was that watershed moment that sparked it?
I have brainstorms like all of us, and we think, oh, that could be done. And then somebody does it because you waited around too long or you don't have the money to do it. But this seemed to be sort of like something doable. And I just thought one day, like, oh, you know, critics organizations, you know, the gays love, quote unquote, the gays love movies and TV, but there's no group. Our group, we have several, if not many, transgender members and bisexuals that identify outright. They're not being coy. We have many lesbians. We have many queers. We have people that identify as fluid and gay men. So we are really LGBTQ across the board. And we're very proud of that. We also have many people of color in our organization. We're pushing for representation of our people in newsrooms, in pitch meetings, in the staff boxes at websites and at magazines and newspapers.
Entertainment critics who want to become a part of Gallica.
Right.
How can they do that? How can they contact you?
Go to Gallica.org, Galeca.org. Go to the Join Us page and you will see a little box to fill out and or just email us, as it says, at info@Galeca.org. And it would be great to hear from people. You know, safety in numbers to really push the media industry to be more inclusive so that TV shows and movies can be more inclusive. Because if you have more people pushing for that, that has an effect on the media world and then in turn an effect on society.
This is Michael Taylor Gray with IMRU Radio Magazine, and I'm speaking to
Andy Ridings.
The award was?
I believe it was Unsung TV Show of the Year.
TV star and show, the other two. How did that show come about?
The writer-creators, Chris Kelly and Sarah Schneider, they used to work as head writers for SNL. They created the show, and I think it's based somewhat on their lives, a little bit here and there. It's about two siblings who are making their way through New York City. They're kind of, I don't want to say degenerates, but they're a little, you know, off.
Do you have any kind of a habit of playing characters that are
a little off?
Yes, I think
I heard a theme going on.
Yeah, there's definitely a theme. I think more often than not, I get cast as kind of arrogant pricks, I would say. You know, whatever pays the bills.
What's that about?
I think I just have one of those faces.
He's cute, he's tall, he's chiseled. He's got to be a jerk. You haven't earned that, have you?
Well, I think I just look like an 80s villain from like a ski movie, like in the 80s. Yeah.
And you also played one of Mitt Romney's sons on 30 Rock. So how's that?
Well, I'm not sure. He's not returning my calls.
You think you should run again?
I don't. I think it's...
Thank you for your honesty.
I think my dad should spend more time at home.
Now, how do you identify with LGBTQI+ community?
I'm an ally.
You are an ally.
Yeah.
And how important is that to you?
Very, very important. I have very many friends who are in the LGBTQ community. And funny story, if you got a minute.
Do we have a minute? Are you listening? Yeah, okay, they're listening. Okay. Give us a minute.
They give us the signal. We had a great bachelor party for my buddy, Peter Dagger. He got married recently in Ohio to a wonderful guy. We did a bachelor party at Fire Island. I'd never been before. Peter wanted to do a dragchler party. So we had a night, we all dressed up in drag.
Who were you?
My drag name was Delicious Wetwood. And my wife, Anne, lent me one of her dresses. I'm going to show you a picture.
I'll look away until you find the photo. Because there may be one of those photos. You're scrolling. I'm not looking.
Scrolling. So there's... That's Delicious.
She works out.
Oh, very much so. Yeah.
And she doesn't shave her arms. You had the bachelor party in Fire Island.
Yeah.
And you had your Dragalicious character.
Yeah, it was wonderful. So,
how'd that evening turn out?
Oh, it was great. Oh, it was amazing. We had a blast. I think we all went down to the beach, and I think we all went swimming, and it was just a wonderful, wonderful time. I don't know how we got on that story, but it was...
Well, because you're an ally.
Oh, right. Oh, yes. Yeah, yeah.
You're at the Dorian Awards for the LGBTQ critics, entertainment critics. Yeah, there are a few LGBTQ+... Folks.
Okay.
We'll call them folks.
Folks
here. Yeah, yeah. That's right. You publish this and show up at this address.
No.
And that's what you do?
Yeah, I go anywhere. Anywhere I'm needed, I go.
I see that. You know what? You just saw a lot of people kind of gathering at this home.
Yeah, I was like,
you thought, I'm just going to kind of walk in. I'm dressed nicely.
Right. I was like, they have bagels.
Yeah, they now have tuna with the bagels. That came a little later. Maybe they were just kind of seeing who was going
to
stick around.
Yeah, we're waiting for the riffraff to get out of here.
Well, that would be me. Yeah. Thank you for all the work that you do.
It's my pleasure.
Congrats on the other two.
Thank you, sir.
And the other three and four that are happening down the line.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So any other projects coming up you want to mention?
I'm going to Atlanta tomorrow to shoot.
Hotlanta.
Never been.
I like you there.
You think so?
Oh, yeah.
To shoot this procedural called The Resident. It's a hospital procedural show for Fox.
How much medicine terminology do you know? Scalpel?
Yeah, no, I know that one. That's scalpel.
It's a letter opener. Where can we find you on social media?
Because
we're going to hunt you.
Okay, great.
Stalk you. Not stalk. We're nice about things.
My wife sometimes calls me Randy, so I go by Randy Ridings on Instagram.
Are you Randy?
Yes.
That's what that means, right?
It's Grandy, yeah.
I'm going to mention that to her on the way out.
Please do. I think I'm on Twitter, but I haven't...
Tell us, what's your handle? What's your screen name? You don't know these things?
A screen name?
Just say your name again.
Andy Ridings.
Spell it out.
A-N-D-Y-R-I-D-I-N-G-S, like riding a horse.
I'm not touching that one. Okay. See, it can happen. It can happen.
Yeah.
There's a thought going...
Yeah,
well, thank you. And thank you. My mom would be proud, too. So, again, you know, I'm going to call Columbus. I'm going to call Fireland. I'm going to follow up on these stories.
Yeah, please do.
But... Tune into the other two.
Yes, yes.
Coming back, right?
Yes, season two, yeah.
Season two?
Yeah.
What do we expect in season two?
My lips are sealed.
You've been listening to Storytellers. What's your story?
So, Michael Taylor Gray, this seems like a fantastic experience, a great segment. What was it like being on location with all these different people? You're an actor, too. What was this like?
Well, it was really fascinating because this home was just gorgeous. It was like walking into a southern mansion. And I come to find out that Patrick Moran, who's the host, and his husband, who's a TV writer, they used this house for part of the location shoot for Feud, which was the story of Bette Davis and Joan Crawford. And the time that they worked together. So it was fascinating to find out some of the home was used for the shooting of that film, not only for our event for that day, but Olivia Wilde was so accessible. She was so lovely. Antonio Banderas was just so humble and just gracious. And I was really pleased to have that sensibility with these actors that I really look up to, and I really admire their work. And as soon as I mentioned IMRU and our place in our community, they were just so pleased to be able to contribute to our legacy. And I look to many more opportunities like this, because it was a fun day. And I felt very fulfilled by the end of the day after having done this wonderful event.
Fantastic. And thank you for doing that. It's a nice insight into this world.
There are still a few minutes left. Enough time for a last word.
And tonight, that's another tale from Hear Me Out, last year's senior storytelling competition. Here's TC on the topic of family.
My mother left rural Arkansas when she was 14 years old. She was tired of picking cotton. She moved to Los Angeles, stayed with a cousin, and found a job. About a year later, she met my father, Willie. And the next year, she had my sister at 17. I followed 3 years later. One night, my father came home one more time, drunk again. They fought. She was tired of fighting. She waited till he passed out. She tied him up. She beat him, packed our bags, and we left, and we never went back. That was the kind of woman my mother was. I remember growing up, there was always something to do. She made things. She sewed all of our clothes, cooked all of our food. She taught us how to garden. She made arts and crafts. These were the things that I remember about her. My mother was really no nonsense. She didn't take any mess. I remember once my sister got into an argument with a boy in the neighborhood, and his older sister came to help him. And my mother came outside and she said, "This is a kid's fight. And if you get into it, I'm going to get into it." So I always felt like she was this person that was strong, was always willing. You know, we all had chores in the house. We all had things that we had to do, cook, clean. She taught us how to garden, how to grow things. And if you heard those heels clicking on a Saturday morning, that meant we were washing walls and cleaning baseboards, you know. She was the kind of lady that always told us the truth, whether we were doing well or whether we weren't doing well, you know. Her line to me was, "The more money you make, the more you spend, the less you accomplish." She told my brother, "You're my son and I love you, but I don't like you very much." And my sister had a baby pretty early. And she was still young and she wanted to party, she wanted to do things, and she didn't want to pay rent. And my mother demanded, if you were old enough to have a child, then you're old enough to take care of it. So you need to pay rent. And she went to her and she said, "Well, I don't have the rent money. I have to pay my car note." And she said, "Well, you and that pretty little baby could go sleep in your car." So she was always straightforward. You know, we grew up as the house where all the kids played. My mother would do serendipitous arts and crafts in the summertime and have all the kids come over. We would go to the local park and swim for the summer. We would get in our Ford station wagon and drive to the beach, to the mountains. So she was always trying to expose us to new things. She turned 40, she found a lump in her breast and brought us all together and explained what was happening. It was really, really sad for all of us and really, really frightful because she was the only person that we had at that time. So she had a mastectomy and everything went well for 10 years. And then it came back. And this time it didn't leave. It ravaged her body. It broke her down. We became the caregivers. But she never lost her spirit. We are all a part of who she is. Strong, willful, honest, and always of service to others. That was my mother, Rosie Mae Miller. She was my guide. She was my friend. She was my champion.
Well, that's the end of our show. We know you have choices on your radio dial and appreciate you spending your time with us.
And thanks to IMRU's executive producer, Steve Pride, Rainbow producers Judd Proctor and Brian Burns.
Find us online at imruradio.org and follow us on Facebook at IMRU Radio. If you're a web designer, social media expert, or just interested in LGBTQI community affairs and would like to volunteer with IMRU, we'd love to have you. Please email volunteer@imruradio.org.
A little reminder, you can always hear our weekly show posted to kpfk.org.
You can also listen to our podcast, where we'll start presenting longer interviews and content too bodacious to broadcast.
And if you want to see us, be sure to check out our promos on IMRU Radio Podcast on YouTube.
Good night.